starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. Living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in there. Watching the coast, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello, this is Deanna. And this is Svengala and Friends, and it is Monday, December 8th, 2014. This program does not have any corporate sponsors, therefore we are free to discuss controversial topics that are not politically correct, and those you might not hear on other programs. My website is Svengala.com. There you will find information about my three books, the Ruling Elite series, as well as a timeline of book two and three. My new book will be coming out soon, perhaps before Christmas, maybe, maybe not. It is entitled Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. Please also visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains the website, SvengalaSpeaks.wordpress.com. He has produced made available all of the more recent audio files of my programs, including the RBN audio files, the American Free Press audio files, and, of course, this program. My Twitter account is twitter.com/DeannaSvengala. If you have questions during the program, you may call in at 646-787-1915. We will also be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@Svengala.com, and, of course, from the chat room, which we invite all of our listeners to participate in, and that is Svengala.chatango.com. Please remember that I do not access my regular email address during the program. Our guest today is James Perloff, who is the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior, as well as previous books, and his website is jamesperloff.com. James, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Deanna. By the way, it doesn't sound like you get enough ways to connect to people there from the ways you just reviewed. I think you need a few more social media things and so forth. You know, sounds kind of barren to me.
I know. I've been toying around with the idea of doing a Facebook. I just resist because I just think they're, well, I don't know. I think they're time consuming, and I did have a personal one, but I quit participating in it maybe 4 or 5 years ago because I had all kinds of people friending me that I'd never heard of. So I thought, this is way too time consuming for me. But anyway. Hmm.
Well, we have that in common. I have a Twitter account like you, but I'm not on Facebook. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Twitter is very handy. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I like to be able to give those short blurbs of relevant information.
Yeah, yeah, I do too. Yeah. So we're
going to talk. It's like an internet 911, you know, just a quick call, you know, something important people should know about.
Exactly, yeah. Well, yesterday was December 7th, the anniversary of the day that will live in infamy. But we've been all indoctrinated and brainwashed into thinking that about a particular way that happened, when in fact it's totally, totally misrepresented by the court historians. So why don't you tell us what really happened?
Yes, I recently posted a major, pretty exhaustive blog post. It's called Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt's 9-1-1. It really walks you through the entire episode of Pearl Harbor, the events leading up to it, the provocation given Japan, the decision to base the fleet in Pearl Harbor, foreknowledge of the attack, and the aftermath of cover-up that took place. But as you were saying, this event, like so many others, so many other geopolitical events, Deanna, are not told to us in a comprehensive or truthful manner by the corporate media, because they have an agenda. They're on the payroll of the CIA or the government or the multinational corporations. As you know, there are just six corporations today that are controlling over 90% of the media. You've got, you know, Time Warner and Disney and Viacom and News Corp and CBS and NBC. And it appears to the public that there's this multiplicity of news outlets, and that gives you the impression that we have a diversity in our free press country, which we do have free press in the Constitution, but when it comes to ownership, that's a different matter. I mean, you just take Time Warner, they own HBO and CNN and Time Magazine and Turner Broadcasting and Warner Brothers and Cinemax and TBS and Sports Illustrated and Fortune and Money and People, and they owned AOL until the recent spinoff. That's just one example, and we could go on forever. But to get the truth today, you have to go to alternative media, and that's why it's so important for people to turn into programs like DNS Bayongol and Friends to find out. But when it comes to Pearl Harbor, most people think it was just this straightforward attack. The Japanese attacked us, and this is because they, like the Germans, wanted to conquer the world. And so we went to a war. It was a righteous war. We were our government was innocent. This was unprovoked aggression, and so we went to war. But there were so many pieces to this that were left out. World War II, really, as you know, Deanna, you've written so exhaustively in your three books, The Ruling Elite, are just such a great comprehensive study of what's gone on over the last couple centuries. But World War II is very much a continuum of World War I. World War I, the banksters made their first venture into an organized world government, which was the League of Nations. That failed. So World War II gave us a bigger and better world government in the form of the UN. And, of course, it's not materialized the way they envisioned, but that was one of their goals. Another goal of both wars was Zionism. And so in World War I, in 1917, of course, we had the Balfour Declaration, by which Britain promised to create a Jewish homeland in return for the Zionist promise to bring America into the war on Britain's side. And World War II, of course, generated the State of Israel and has given us all the Zionist tragedies we now see taking place in the Middle East. In addition to that, there was the communism factor. We have World War I generating milieu for the creation of the first communist state, the Soviet Union, which, of course, is funded by the Rothschilds and the Kuhn-Loeb interests to generate that Bolshevik Talmudic state, which became a bane to the world. And then World War II was used to spread communism really over half the planet, over into Eastern Europe and into the Asian mainland. In addition to that, we had world banking on the continuum. We had the Federal Reserve created just 6 months before Archduke Ferdinand's assassination, which touched off World War I. And then World War II, the Council on Foreign Relations and private study groups created the plans for the World Bank. And, of course, as you know, they're with the world government. They want to have a world bank, which will go beyond the current perimeters of activity by the current World Bank. They want a world currency, just as they have the euro for the European Union and the proposed Amero for a proposed North American Union. So World War I, World War II, same dynamics. Now, to get America into World War II, they were following the same pattern. You know, one thing I've noticed about the Illuminati or the establishment or whatever term we choose to call this world oligarchy that is controlling geopolitical events World War One, they got us in through the sinking of the Lusitania. And on my website, jamespoloff.com, I do have an extensive post called False Flag at Sea, which summarizes, using the work of many good authors before me, on how the Lusitania was a setup. Winston Churchill had it sent directly into the path of a German U-boat. It was a passenger ship, and it was presented to the American public as the destruction of innocent life, women and children, by the Germans just because they like to kill women and children, when in fact, unknownst to the public, the Lusitania was carrying millions of rounds of rifle ammunition, as well as tens of tons of gun cotton, which the British used as explosive in their mines, and tens of tons of aluminum powder, which they used in their artillery. And, of course, the Lusitania just exploded. It just this ship went down in 18 minutes, this huge ship, which had been the largest ship afloat when it was first launched. That was superseded in that distinction eventually by the Titanic. I'm sorry.
Let me just ask a question. Don't you think it's kind of fascinating that the same people that were in the government, FDR, and Churchill, that kind of orchestrated that event because they were both working in a position that they could have some sort of managerial presence over the Lusitania event?
Yeah, there were men who were trusted by the Zionist bankster establishment. Interesting, if you follow the pattern, you know, like today, how we're told you have a lot of choices to vote. You can always vote for a Clinton or a Bush in the elections. You know, a lot of choices. You know, but this, we see the same personnel, continuity personnel, taking place long ago. For example, during the Spanish-American War, the very proactive Assistant Secretary of the Navy, who was running the show. When the Maine was sunk, was Teddy Roosevelt, and that was in the Spanish-American War was the summer of 1898. By the fall of 1898, he'd become governor of New York, and by 1901, he was president of the United States. You look at FDR, when the Lusitania went down, he, like his cousin, Teddy Roosevelt, was assistant secretary of the Navy. He then went on to become governor of New York and president of the United States. And Winston Churchill was his cousin, a distant cousin, who had overseen, exactly as you're saying, he'd overseen the sinking of the Lusitania. And now, as World War II approaches, these two men are not Navy administrative personnel. They are now heads of state, president and prime minister, which is really quite frightening. And we have a scenario where they're trying to duplicate the success. Just as the Lusitania followed on the success of the sinking of the Maine, they were trying to duplicate that success again. And so you had all these provocations given to Germany because they wanted another Lusitania. They wanted another Lusitania, so FDR was having the American destroyers escort British convoys and pursue German destroyers. Because, you know, boy, if we get another ship sunk by the Germans, we'll get right into World War II, just like Wilson arranged, you know, with his British colleagues. But it didn't work out. The American people had wised up to World War I. There'd been Harry Elmer Barnes and other revisionist authors had blown the whistle on World War I. A lot of people had figured out that the war was not about making the world safe for democracy. Banksters had cheated the American people out of billions of dollars worth of armaments that were not manufactured. This was brought out by the Graham Committee of Congress post-war. The Lusitania was exposed for what it was by people like Senator Robert La Follette. And the American people were over 80%, according to the Gallup poll, did not want to join World War II. So eventually Churchill and Roosevelt figured out, you know, we're not going to get into this war with just a Lusitania. We needed about a dozen Lusitanias, which is what they got at Pearl Harbor. But I should mention that the Germans were wised up too, just like the American public. They knew that the Lusitania had gotten America into World War One, which shifted the balance of power against them, which cost them the war. And they were not going to sink any American ships, no matter how much we provoked them. And I just want to quote what Admiral Dönitz said during the Nuremberg trials. He said, quote, "A 300-mile safety zone was granted to America by Germany," this is pre-war, "when international law called for only a 3-mile zone. I suggested minefields at Halifax and around Iceland, but the Führer rejected this because he wanted to avoid conflict with the United States. When American destroyers in the summer of 1941 were ordered to attack German submarines, I was forbidden to fight back. I was thus forced not to attack British destroyers for fear that there might be some mistake, unquote. That's Admiral Dönitz, the commander of the Germany's U-boat fleet. And so the Germans were giving Churchill and Roosevelt no satisfaction. And so this is why they turned to Japan. And as Harold Icke said, the Secretary of the Interior under Roosevelt, he said, quote, I believe that our best entrance into the war would be by Japan. So that's when they started moving towards provoking Japan.
Ah, okay. Sure. Because they were allies, and that would be just a perfect way of doing it.
That's right. And most people, they know that, of course they know that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, but if you ask them why, they're a little hesitant to and unable to come up with a real reason. And what most people don't know is that we did provoke that attack. And, of course, first the American people were set up by portraying the Japanese as bent on world conquest. And in my, you know, I've got on my current blog post on Pearl Harbor, I have a embedded YouTube clip there, and it's Joseph Grew of the Council on Foreign Relations. Is a wartime movie called Our Enemy, the Japanese. And I'm going to quote exactly what he says in that clip. He says, quote, the Japanese believe it is the right and destiny of Japan's emperors to rule the whole world,
wow,
to destroy all nations and peoples which stand in the way of its fulfillment. Their dream is to see Tokyo established as the capital of the world. World conquest is their national obsession, unquote. Well, you know, Diana, Japan is smaller than Montana. You know, the idea that
right,
it was conquer the world, it was absurd. And I've pointed, you know, you were the one who clued me to this, but, you know, they were not, they were a closed, of course, isolationist country that wanted to mind their own business until Commodore Perry sailed in 1854 and forced them to sign a trade treaty with the United States under threat of naval bombardment. But it was your book in The Ruling Elite that clued me to the fact that Commodore Perry was the father-in-law of August Belmont, who was the Rothschild's leading financial agent in the United States of the 19th century. It's amazing, again, how these personnel connect, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they also put up all kinds of, I talked a little bit about this last Monday, how they provoked them economically. They sanctioned them. They did everything they could economically to force their hand. I mean, it was terrible. It's very similar to what international Jewry did in the spring of 1933 against Germany, and at about the same time. So you have these economic warfare declared against two nations.
Right. In fact, I think Ron Paul recently stated in terms of the Middle East that sanctions are a act of war, economic sanctions, and that's what they did to Japan. Some of your listeners might benefit from him in a couple of quotes. This first one is from the British historian Russell Grenfell. He'd been a captain in the Royal Navy, and he wrote this in 1952. He said, quote, no reasonably informed person can now believe that Japan made a villainous, unexpected attack on the United States. An attack was not only fully expected, but was actually desired. It is beyond doubt that President Roosevelt wanted to get his country into war, but for political reasons was most anxious to ensure that the first act of hostility came from the other side, for which reason he caused increasing pressure, that's the sanctions we're talking about, to be put on the Japanese to a point that no self-respecting nation could endure without resort to arms. Japan was meant by the American president to attack the United States, unquote. That's from Russell Grenfell. Here's a second quote. This quote is from Oliver Littleton, who was actually Churchill's minister of production. And on June 20th, 1944, he was given an address before the American Chamber of Commerce in London, and he said, quote, America provoked Japan to such an extent that the Japanese were forced to attack Pearl Harbor. It is a travesty on history ever to say that America was forced into war, unquote. So let's just talk about what these men are referring to. What was the provocation? Japan had sent its troops into Manchuria. And this was betrayed by people like Joseph Grew and Roosevelt and the American press and Hollywood, that Japan was bent on world conquest because they'd sent their troops into Manchuria, which was somewhat incorrectly called Northern China. And this was supposed to be part of their plot to conquer the world. But what they never mentioned, was that the Japanese did this primarily, and I wouldn't say the word they'd never had any imperialistic ambitions, but they did this primarily as a response to Soviet expansion. Joseph Stalin was on a mission of Soviet expansion. Of course, we know he invaded the Balkans and Finland and Poland and Romania in the West, but in the East, he had expanded and he attacked Outer Mongolia and had taken over Xinjiang, which is the northwestern province of China, as it was then called. And just going to quote Dr. Anthony Kubik on this. He was chairman of the History Department at the University of Dallas. Here's what he wrote in his book called How the Far East Was Lost. Quote, "It was apparent to Japanese statesmen that unless bastions of defense were built in Manchuria and Inner Mongolia, communism would spread through all of North China and seriously threaten the security of Japan. But the State Department seemed not to regard Japan as a bulwark against Soviet expansion in China. As a matter of fact, not one word of protest was sent by the State Department to the Soviet Union, despite her absorption of Xinjiang and Outer Mongolia, while at the same time Japan was censured for stationing troops in China," unquote. So here we have this big double standard that, as you know, Deanna, occurred throughout the war. They had zero tolerance for what they would call acts of aggression by Germany or Japan, but they had unlimited tolerance for anything Stalin did. And one of the grand ironies, and even before I was really clued in World War II, it struck me as extremely strange that when war broke out in September of 1939 between Poland and Germany, that England and France declared war on Germany, but when Stalin invaded Poland in that very same month, September 1939, no declaration of war, no response, everybody yawns, it's no big deal. But this is what happened with Japan was the same thing. There was total tolerance for Stalin moving into Asia, but zero tolerance for Japan to act in its own interest. And, you know, we sent troops to Vietnam halfway around the world because we said that stopping the expansion of communism was in our national interest. So why couldn't the Japanese do it when communism was threatening on their very doorstep? And so what we did, though, we said that it was an act of aggression by the Japanese, and we placed an embargo on them. And it's this very important trade embargo that is the is what's going to lead to Pearl Harbor. The embargo was joined in by Britain and the Dutch, and we were embargoing oil, which Japan was dependent on for imports. There was no OPEC then. You had to go through the Dutch, the Americans, or the English. And we also they were dependent on imports for 75% of their food and for most of their natural resources. And the timing of this embargo is something I really consider to be extremely significant, Deanna. You know, there was a memo sent to President Roosevelt on the need for this oil embargo. And let me just grab a quote. I've actually got a PDF of it. This is from Secretary Ickes to President Roosevelt. He said, quote, "There will never be so good a time to stop the shipment of oil to Japan as we now have. To embargo oil to Japan would be popular. There might develop from the embargoing of oil to Japan such a situation as would make it not only possible but easy to get into this war in an effective way. And if we should thus indirectly be brought in, we would avoid the criticism we had gone in as an ally of Russia," unquote. Now, the date on this memo is June the 23rd, 1941, which to avid historians will know that is the day after Operation Barbarossa began, when Germany, and I always like to point out to people, you know, it was supposed, the way the media portrayed it was Operation Barbarossa was Germany's, part of Germany's plan to conquer the world. To the contrary, Operation Barbarossa was a six-nation attack. It also was Finland, Croatia, Italy, Romania, and Hungary. These nations were attempting not to conquer the world, but they were attempting to wipe out Bolshevism and the threat that it represented. And as you also know, of course, Spain sent 47,000 volunteers, or I should say 47,000 volunteers came from Spain. And were they on a mission to conquer the world? And what about those divisions from Belgium that nobody talks about, Leon de Grel? The Belgians, they were there not to conquer the world. The Belgians were there as part of this effort to destroy communism, which, of course, was an Illuminati creation. Again, the Rothschilds and Kuhn Lieb had created it, and it was their interest to defend it. And they knew that if Japan attacked Russia from the east, that Stalin would be caught in the vise, and communist Russia would be destroyed. And that, I believe, is why the oil embargo was enacted. It was enacted in around the end of July of 1941. And at that point, all these news reports were coming in that the Germans and their allies were crushing the Soviets. They were surrendering en masse. They threw up their hands and said, Stalin, kaput. And they knew that if Japan attacked, and there were already skirmishing with the Russians on their frontiers in Mongolia, that Stalin was done for. So the oil embargo prevented Japan from joining that war effort. We don't know for sure that they would have, but without oil, you can't prosecute war. You can't fly a plane or run a ship or a tank or a jeep. And so the Japanese turned south, and they knew that there was plenty of oil to be had in the Dutch East Indies. And that's what Ickes is talking about when he talks about the oil embargo, when he mentions the Dutch East Indies in that memo to Roosevelt the day after Operation Barbarossa began. So the oil embargo and all-out trade embargo was given to Japan, and they seriously negotiated to have that repealed. And they said, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll pull our troops out of Southeast Asia, which they were in by the invitation of the Vichy government, because Indochina had been under French control, but now Vichy said you can go in. They said, we'll pull all of our troops out of China and Southeast Asia, but we need to leave them in Manchuria because we need that for national defense. And we gave them an ultimatum. We said, no, you have to pull all troops into all your troops into Japan. And just imagine how Americans would feel if some other country told us we had to pull all of our troops back to the United States. We wouldn't take that from another country. And so the Japanese said, well, you've given us a two-headed coin. Either we die by starvation for this trade embargo, but if we pull all of our troops back into Japan, communism will engulf China and Asia, which is exactly what happened after the war, right?
Sure.
China became communist, and we had the Korean War and the Vietnam War. They were exactly right. And so they said, well, it's either death by communism or death by starvation. We choose neither one. We're going to fight. And that is the provocation. That ultimatum, by the way, was written by Harry Dexter White of the Treasury Department, who was, we now know, a Soviet agent. And I have a link to the Time magazine article that acknowledges this, because even mainstream media now admits that Harry Dexter White wrote that ultimatum to Japan and was in the employ of the Soviets.
Yeah. Wow. I love all the images that you've included in your article. I think it just really adds a lot. Yeah. It's fabulous. Fabulous.
Well, we're in a visual age, and one thing that you know, I love these WordPress sites because you can so easily work with them. You don't need to know the HTML codes, but I do have embedded videos there, a very high quality, high definition video of Roosevelt's declaration of war and color image of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Because a lot of young people, they don't even know what Pearl Harbor was. You know, so I just want to start off with what the attack was. You know,
sure.
Of course, it was the attack that led us into war and launched from Japanese aircraft carriers, and more than 2,000 Americans were killed, and 18 ships were either sunk or heavily damaged. And it was a horrific scene, reminiscent of the kind of horror of 9/11 in its own time. And of course, it led to a very avid declaration of war, whereas Americans had been against that prior to the attack.
Sure. Yeah. I like the map that you've used also, showing Pearl Harbor on that day and where all the ships were. And I mean, it's a Planet Wear map. It's terrific.
Well, and that brings up a very important point. You know, the map shows how closely our ships were boxed together in Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And this is something that a lot of people never ask is, why was the fleet in Pearl Harbor in the first place? Because normally the U.S. Navy kept the Pacific Fleet berthed on the west coast of America. And the decision to base the fleet at Pearl Harbor was not a naval one. It was made by President Roosevelt. And when the fleet commander at that time, J.L. Richardson, heard of this decision, he went to see Washington, went to Washington to speak to Roosevelt. This was October the 8th, 1940. And he had a litany of reasons why this was a very bad idea to move the fleet to Pearl Harbor. And so let's just go over those reasons. Number one, of course, as we were just saying, the fleet would be like sardines in a can, very easy targets for bombers. Also, Pearl Harbor is isolated in the middle of the ocean, so it's vulnerable to attack from 360 degrees, whereas if you kept the fleet on the West Coast, it's almost impossible to make a surprise attack because, you know, you're going to run into all kinds of commercial shipping before you ever got to our coastline. Plus, to supply the fleet, you had to now bring oil and supplies across 2,000 miles of Pacific or even replacement personnel, and they had very inadequate dry docks in Pearl Harbor, very poor fuel storage, inadequate training facilities. The men, and you had tens of thousands of soldiers and of sailors in the Pacific Fleet would now be separated from their families, creating morale problems. Also, 37% of Hawaii's population was ethnically Japanese. So if you're thinking of war with Japan, isn't this a bad place to put the fleet? Because you're subject to all kinds of espionage, if not sabotage. And so there were all these reasons not to put the fleet in Pearl Harbor. And President Roosevelt could not rebut these reasons, and he simply told Richardson that if we put the fleet in Pearl Harbor, by moving it closer to Japan, that would deter Japanese aggression. And that was the one reason he gave. And, of course, as of December the 7th, 1941, everyone knew that Roosevelt was wrong about that. Obviously, it did not deter Japanese aggression one bit, but the public was never informed that this had been Roosevelt's decision. As you know, all of the blame was laid upon the Navy. He was never held accountable by the newspapers or by mainstream court historians.
Right.
And I should also mention, by the way, that after this meeting with Roosevelt, J.L. Richardson was fired as fleet commander. And so he went to the Navy Secretary Frank Knox to ask about it. And I'm going to quote exactly what Admiral Richardson said. He said, quote, "When I saw the secretary, he said, in all my experience in the Navy, I've never known of a flag officer being detached in the same manner as I, and I feel I owe it to myself to know why. The secretary said the president would send for me and talk the matter over," unquote. But Roosevelt never sent for Richardson, and all Knox eventually told Richardson was, quote, "The last time you were here, you hurt the president's feelings," unquote. Yeah, you heard that. That's the reason he was fired. You can see the reason, because he knew this was a terrible idea. So he was replaced as fleet commander by husband Kimmel. Kimmel took that position assuming that the president was a patriot who would keep him informed of any intelligence pointing to an attack on Pearl Harbor.
Sure. Terrible, terrible, terrible.
But we see this throughout history, don't we? The false flags again and again. And one reason I like to write on Pearl Harbor is that what we see going on in the world today is more clearly understood when we know the context, when we know the pattern that precedes, when we know that 911 does not stand alone. When we go back and look at the Maine and the Lusitania, and Pearl Harbor, and Tonkin Gulf, and the Kuwaiti baby incubator deaths that never happened, and the weapons of mass destruction that were never found. And we see that pretext after pretext after pretext that were false have been used to deceive the American people into going to war. 911 becomes a lot more credible as a false flag. People poo-poo it. They poo-poo it less when they see how history has set this pattern and how the same oligarchy has been calling the shots and making these geopolitical events happen.
Exactly, yeah. It's a pattern. That's why it's so important to study history, and that's why I always say that that history is prologue. I mean, that is just, you just have to have a sense of what happened before in order to understand, all of these things. just essential.
And Deanna, that's an excellent place to recommend your three-volume series, The Ruling Elite, because I don't know that anyone from an alternative media perspective has so exhaustively looked at the history of the last two centuries. Maybe two centuries isn't quite an accurate description of the time frame, but in the events that are leading right through. Do you have a fourth one in mind, by the way, a fourth Ruling Elite? I know you've gone through World War II.
Kind of. I did go through World War II, but just in Europe. And I was going to include the war in the Pacific, and the book would have been twice the size, so I thought, oh, no, I can't do that. So it's kind of written. I just have to clean it up a bit. But I started working on this other book that I just sent to the publisher, so I have to think about what I want to do.
Well, you're very prolific, and I just want to recommend these books as reference. They're encyclopedic in terms of an alternative media view of the history of events, stuff that the mainstream media publishing houses will not tell you in their history books. And it's just a great reference for anyone to have on their bookshelf. You can just look it up and find out so many facts about history from any episode.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I didn't pay you to say that.
Well, you're paying me by having me on your show, but I we both have the same goal, and our reward is just the satisfaction of telling the truth.
Exactly. When you have an obligation to share what you've learned, and just reading about all of these things without disseminating what you've learned is kind of a sin, in my opinion. You really do have an obligation to share. So, and to educate other people. And that's what you do in such a detailed way. I love this page. I love the way that you set it up. Although I have a website, I've never really used a lot of the I don't know how to embed a video. I've never done it because I don't have a WordPress. This is a WordPress, and yet it is jamesperloff.com. Oh, interesting. That is interesting.
Yeah, it's WordPress.com, and updating the site is it's about as easy as using Microsoft Word. Again, you don't have to know the codes to do it. And sometimes it's something I can't figure out, but usually if you go to YouTube, you can find an instructional video.
Don't
and
you
I have
love
a web,
those?
Web designer as well who I can always call upon if there's something that I can't figure out. But I do like that, especially we're in a modern era where especially younger people like a lot of visuals. And well, I like visuals too.
Sure.
But it adds authority to what you're saying when you can support a point you're making with a visual image. And I tried to do that, for example, a lot of your listeners or some of them at least may be familiar with my older book, The Shadows of Power. And we tried to put a lot of pictures in there because when I tried to show, for example, the relationship of J.P. Morgan to the Council on Foreign Relations, I was able to find a picture in an historical archive of the founding president of the Council on Foreign Relations, John W. Davis, right next to J.P. Morgan at a congressional hearing because he was J.P. Morgan's personal attorney. And when you can use visual supports for something you are saying ideationally, it's a great help.
Absolutely.
It's makes the abstract concrete.
Absolutely, yeah. And you do that so well. That is really great.
Well, I discovered some things. I was going on YouTube, and I was able to find testimony of General Walter Short before Congress about how he was denied vital information, as well as a clip of Admiral Kimmel. And so those are there, too, video clips from them testifying before Congress in 1945-46. And that just adds support and just shows that we're not making this up, that these commanders were scapegoated, and we'll let you see them speak for themselves.
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
And speaking of that, what were they denied? Another major, major point that needs to be made about Pearl Harbor is that Washington knew this attack was coming. Hawaii did not, and they did everything to make sure that Hawaii did not know. But this is almost the bread and butter of Pearl Harbor, is the foreknowledge of the attack. And there were many ways that they knew this attack was coming. One was the magic intercepts. Now,
right.
What this refers to is Japan was using a very sophisticated code, secret code, to communicate to its embassies throughout the world. And it was so complex, it had to be enciphered by a machine and then deciphered by another machine on the other side. And the Japanese thought it could not be broken. But we had very talented cryptanalysts in our War Department who broke the code, and they've developed their own machine. So in Washington, we're actually reading their diplomatic messages on a same-day basis, or very soon. And there were an array of important personnel getting these intercepts, including the president, of course, and George Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, and the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of War, and even Harry Hopkins, who was this shadowy figure who lived in the White House, kind of like Edward Mandel House had lived in the White House
right.
under Woodrow Wilson. But he got to see the messages, but not the Hawaiian commanders, who were at the mercy of Washington. But what these intercepts revealed was that the Japanese had told their embassy, or consulate in Hawaii, to start telling Tokyo the exact locations of each ship and dock, you know. And they had messages going back to Hawaii saying things like, there appear to be no torpedo nets, there seems to be no alarm, sailors still on shore leave. This is all in December of 1941, you know. And they knew this, but that Hawaii was not told that, you know. They also knew in Washington that on November the 30th, Tokyo told the Berlin embassy to tell the Germans that, quote, the breaking out of war may come quicker than anyone dreams, unquote, that they told the North American offices to start burning their code machines and secret documents because, you know, once the war broke out, they're going to lose their diplomatic immunity, and they didn't want any secret documents being found. It's so obvious that war was on the doorstep, and, of course, their own – I wouldn't call it declaration of war, but their message, rupturing relations, was translated on December the 6th. 13 parts of that 14-part message are already in Roosevelt's hands on the 6th. And there's a former Justice Department official named Daryl Borquist who has a website, which I link to for my article. He's examined the original draft of Roosevelt's Day of Infamy speech and has demonstrated that he started writing it on December the 6th. He certainly knew that it was coming.
Of course.
That was one means that, but that was not the only one.
Right. Amazing.
Another means that they knew war was coming was it was called the East Wind Rain message. Now, not all of Japan's offices were equipped with one of these magic, they called it the purple code decoding machines. They had small consulates in smaller cities that didn't have it, in smaller offices. And so they arranged that if war was coming with either Britain, Russia, or the United States, a special message would be broadcast during a weather report. And if war was coming with the United States, the message was to be Higashi no Kaze Ami, which means east wind rain. East wind meant United States, rain meant war. And that message was broadcast on December the 4th. All of our monitoring stations were listening for it. We picked it up. It was broadcast. And so that was another clue that war was imminent with Japan. Of course, that was not relayed to Pearl Harbor. Another means, which is actually many means within it, is the personal warnings that were given to Washington, and we can enumerate those. January 27, 1941, Joseph Grew, I alluded to him earlier, he was our ambassador to Japan. He said, quote, in a message to the president, quote, the Peruvian minister has informed a member of my staff that he has heard from many sources, including a Japanese source, that in the event of trouble breaking out between the United States and Japan, the Japanese intend to make a surprise attack against Pearl Harbor with all their strength, unquote. We also have Brigadier General Elliot Thorpe. He was the U.S. military observer in Java, which the Dutch then controlled, and the Dutch decoded a dispatch from Tokyo to Bangkok, which said that Hawaii was going to be attacked. This is December of 1941. So the Dutch were very alarmed, and they informed General Thorpe, who was also very alarmed. And I have embedded on this post of mine on Pearl Harbor a complete BBC video made in 1989 called Sacrifice at Pearl Harbor. You can see General Thorpe interviewed, and he will tell you there, and this is also in books on Pearl Harbor, which I reference. General Thorpe said he sent a grand total of 4 warnings to Washington concerning Pearl Harbor because he thought it was so vital, and Washington finally told him to send no more warnings about Hawaii. And The Dutch also had their military attaché, Colonel F.G.L. Weijerman, personally warn Army Chief of Staff George Marshall about Pearl Harbor. This is just days before the attack. We also have Dusko Popov. He was a double agent, a spy, working for both Germany and America, but his true allegiance was to the United States. He learned from information from the Germans that the Japanese were planning to attack Pearl Harbor. He notified J. Edgar Hoover, who relayed that to the president, and you can see Dusko Popov as well as witnesses to Hoover's telling the president that in that BBC documentary, Sacrifice at Pearl Harbor. You also have Senator Guy Gillette of Iowa. He was informed by a member of the Sino-Korean People's League. Of course, Korea was under the control of Japan. They had some a movement against that. Kyil-soo Han informed Gillette after getting nowhere with the State Department that the Pearl Harbor attack was coming, and Gillette had a private audience with the president to warn him about the attack. And also we have U.S. Congressman Martin Dies of Texas, who states that he came into possession of a map revealing the plan to attack Pearl Harbor. And I'm going to quote exactly what he said, quote, "As soon as I received the document, I telephoned Secretary of State Cordell Hull and told him what I had. Secretary Hull directed me not to let anyone know about the map and stated that he would call me as soon as he had talked to President Roosevelt. In about an hour, he telephoned to say that he talked to Roosevelt and they agreed that it would be very serious if any information concerning this map reached the news services. I told him it was a grave responsibility to withhold such vital information from the public. The secretary assured me that he and Roosevelt considered it essential to national defense," unquote, United States Congressman Martin Dies. And there are others, but that is a good sampling.
Yeah, that's plenty of warnings. Definitely. And there were people who knew about it apparently just all over. Well, except, of course, the American public. And the
American public. This is, as with 911, this is a case where only a few are in the know. And
sure.
That is almost always the case. And that is why people need to recognize that we do not have the open democratic government that we believe we have, where we simply have public servants that are responsible to the American voter.
Right. And, of course, the 2,400 people that were slaughtered in at Pearl Harbor. Of course, they didn't know anything about it.
Yes, they were heroes. You know, they went to the battle stations. I believe they knocked out 48 Japanese planes, which is much their credit. That in a complete surprise attack, that they were able to get to their guns and inflict that much damage on Sunday morning when no attack had been expected. And so those men are heroes, but they were betrayed. And I always like to point out to people, Dana, because some people think they were unpatriotic, they were somehow doing a disservice to the American military to talk about this. No, we are on the side of the victims, but we were against the people who betrayed the men at Pearl Harbor, who betrayed the men in the field.
Absolutely. And it was such a betrayal. Oh, gosh. I mean, it was just I can't imagine how these scoundrels could possibly sleep at night knowing that they are putting so many people at risk. And yet it happens all the time. It has happened throughout history, and it will continue to occur.
It's been said that when the Lusitania went down and Woodrow Wilson heard the news, he went and wept quietly to himself for several minutes by himself. I doubt that Churchill expressed any such remorse, but you're right. It's happened again and again, and this is representative of the mindset of men who, for the sake of personal advancement, for fame, wealth, and position, will trade off and pay their masters by deeds that are truly abhorrent and cause death to many, that are, you know, repugnant not only to us, but are repugnant to God. It's murder. It's betrayal of the position of trust that have been given by the American people.
Exactly. Yeah. And they seem to think it's for the better good, that it's that the end result will justify the deaths of these people. But I don't think that you can ever justify that reasonably. I don't know how they do it. I think they must be psychopathic, obviously, because it isn't just the 2,400. It's all the deaths during the war that they created. And when you look at all of the warfare that has been created via a false flag, all the countries that have been ruined, the lives that have been destroyed, the infrastructure that has been destroyed, that is just wanton destruction of people, of their efforts, of their cultures. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you know, Dana, sometimes people say that when we talk about these things, we're doom and gloomers. Well, you know, I think that these people are the doom and gloomers, because just as you have enunciated, they're the ones who have brought doom and gloom. The Federal Reserve destroying our American economy, the wars that have taken the lives of young men, that's doom and gloom. What you and I want to do is to get rid of this trend, to get rid of these lies, and to restore the world to the type of leadership, the type of economy, the type of society that it should have.
Sure.
So we're actually we want to see a happy land, and we're not going to get it if we continue down the same path that the mainstream media and this hidden oligarchy has been bringing us.
Exactly. And like I said before, you have a responsibility. And once you figure some of this stuff out, you cannot ever go back to that place of innocence where you can just do nothing about it. You can never return. You can never say, oh, you know, why should I worry about this? Nobody else seems to worry about it. So I'm just going to go back and do what I was doing before I ever learned about this. And just forget. You cannot do that. It's just impossible to do. I mean,
if you've got any kind of heart, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. Life would be easier not losing friends over some of the stuff that we talk about. And I'm sure that it there are people that when they see people like you and I coming along, they don't want to hear about this stuff, because if they do learn about it, it makes them feel, well, gosh, I was really duped. I'm really not very bright. And then, of course, it puts a responsibility on them. So they prefer to live in a state of denial, but it's impossible.
Right. Well, we were all duped. I was certainly duped. In fact, I was duped on 9/11. In fact, I wrote an article very shortly after 9/11 for WorldNet Daily, in which I compared Osama bin Laden to the old man of the mountain who lived about 1000 AD. He was a commander of the assassins, who were this Muslim sect that was utterly ruthless. And because I believed the initial report after 9/11, I did not identify that as a false. So I was duped, and and I've had to change my mind about a number of historical matters and say, you know, I bought that one and I shouldn't have, because it takes time sometimes to dissect the facts and to come to a correct conclusion. But admitting that you're wrong about something is a part of maturity, and something that hopefully people can recognize the need to do is to change their worldview from, I guess people, I haven't seen the movie The Matrix, but I'm gathering the lingo now, from the blue pill view of the world that the mainstream media has painted, and we instead swallow the bitter red pill and see the world in reality.
Right. Yes. And I've had to change my way of thinking frequently, because when I was growing up, certainly I believed all the books that I read, and then I thought, well, I've got to read and see what the other side says. And if I tried to recapture or restate some of the things that I used to write about, oh my gosh, it would be impossible, because, well, back in 2005 when I first began writing things on the internet, I had a lot of views that I no longer have. And I've always read books. I've always been, I thought, well-educated, self-educated. But you have a responsibility to keep learning. And when you do learn that you've been wrong about something, you should own it. You should own your mistakes. And I note that people who are really doing research have to own a lot of their mistakes, because in doing research, you always find out, whoops, I was wrong about this or wrong about that. And I'm human, and humans do that. We goof.
That's right. Everybody in the world makes mistakes, and it's necessary to acknowledge them. Just giving another example from my writing career, I wrote an article for the New American on the Lindbergh kidnapping, and I took the position that Richard Hauptmann was innocent. You know, he'd gone to the electric chair proclaiming his innocence, and there was circumstantial evidence pointing to Lindbergh's enemies, and there was also some falsification of evidence in the court against Hauptmann, and I believe that there was a strong case he was innocent. But I participated in something called the Lindbergh Kidnap Discussion Board, and I got into a debate with a guy in Britain who'd studied this case at large, and it went back and forth and back and forth. And finally I said to him, you know what? We're just talking about one angle of the case. I said, you know what? You're right. As more and more pieces came into place, I finally realized that article I wrote was wrong. It was circumstantial. It was wrong. And Hauptmann had done it. That's for another radio show to talk about. But this is a case where it took 500 posts on this board before I finally reversed myself. And that's what a good jury member will do. You know, I do like that movie 12 Angry Men, where
I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah. Well, you know, they start thinking the guy is guilty, and then they conclude that he's innocent, or at least they don't have the preponderance of evidence that they thought. And that's the way we should look at history, isn't it? We should look at it thoroughly, logically, see what makes the most sense, strip away our prejudices, admit we're wrong when we need to, and come to a logical and hopefully just conclusion. And so that's the way we need to take all of these events in history. And sometimes that's going to mean revising our position, and that's totally okay. It's totally okay to be wrong about something and to come to a new conclusion when that's where the evidence leads. Which is, by the way, very similar to the scientific process, isn't it? Just like inventions. How many times did Edison have to find out he was wrong and take another course before he got that light bulb? And that's a very similar process, I think, when we're looking at history, is that we try this and we look at this and we modify our conclusions. Just as a scientist would, and that's a good approach. That's an honest and approach with integrity.
Sure, and there are probably some entities that you no longer write for, simply because they have a particular agenda, and you're no longer adept at helping them with that agenda.
Well, you know, I have changed my position on some things. You know, my earlier book, The Shadows of Power, made zero mention of Zionism, because you know what? I had never been exposed to anything about Zionism. And I just, you know, kind of assumed the typical Christian, if you can call it Christian view, or at least within Christian churches today, that, Zionism is a good thing. But the more I went over to the crossed the tracks and went to the other side of town and lived with the people like Benjamin Friedman and other people were saying about the Zionist movement. And of course, I'm half Jewish myself. I said, you know what? The same guys who funded Zionism also funded world government and communism, the Rothschilds. And I said, you know, there's something wrong here. And when you look at the evil that's been perpetrated by the Zionists in Israel upon not only Gaza, but of course all of the Palestinians, and you start to fit into a new paradigm, and that's what I've done there. And so you're right. The sort of what you might call mainstream conservative Americanist worldview I had before is in many respects the same. I still obviously have the same view of the Bill of Rights and the Federal Reserve and world government, but I have had to modify my views, just as we were talking about before, on some subjects.
Absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. And, yeah, that's what mature people do.
And by the way, I think it's important. I think it's important that we remember this process when we view others who don't agree with us, because I think it's very easy sometimes for people to fall in a trap when someone doesn't agree with them to think, well, you must be a shill for the CIA or the Zionists or something. Because
right.
And when in fact they're just simply like us, they're works in progress. They haven't examined the data to the degree that we have in certain areas in. So but that doesn't mean that they're secretly, you know, working for evil. It just means that their level of recognition of facts in some of these areas has not come to the point that we have. And we need to give them time just like we needed time. So I always try to encourage that kind of tolerance within the alternative media community that we're not all at the same level. We all haven't studied the facts as much as other people have. And there are a lot of things I still need to learn about. And so I just think that that is proper, that we should give people elbow room and give them time to grow.
Exactly, because we are not all looking at the same stuff. We don't all have the same time frame. And we are not, everybody is unequally educated or interested. What might interest me might be different than what somebody else is focusing on. So, absolutely. Certainly. I don't think that people should be banished or criticized or vilified simply because they do not believe exactly the same way that we do.
That's right. And I think that that makes us them more open to us when we don't act in condemnation towards them. And just take, loving and understanding attitude towards them. And sometimes that gets you the same attitude in return. You know, respect is mutual. But maybe we could get back to just finishing this Pearl Harbor business. We were talking about Pearl Harbor and that they knew from diplomatic intercepts, from the Higashi Nakazi Ami message, and from these various warnings that they'd received. There was one more that method of foreknowledge that got broken in the year 2000 by Robert Stinnett. I'm sure a number of your listeners are familiar with. He published a book in 2000 called Day of the Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. And he broke new ground by revealing that the United States was not only decoding the diplomatic intercepts, but they had also broken some of the naval codes. And the codes included this message, this which was from Admiral Yamamoto to the Japanese First Air Fleet. The date was November 25th, 1941. And here's the quote. Quote, "The task force, keeping its movement strictly secret and maintaining close guard against submarines and aircraft, shall advance into Hawaiian waters, and upon the very opening of hostilities, shall attack the main force of the United States fleet and deal it a mortal blow. The first air raid is planned for the dawn of X day, exact date to be given by later order," unquote. And of course, no one could mistake the meaning of that. And there's actually a little clip that when Michael Rivero saw the article, he sent it to me. I've embedded it. It's a short clip he did called "The Bones of Station H." That is the station that actually intercepted that message.
Ah. Now, didn't Stinnett, he really was kind of, he thought that FDR did the right thing. I mean, he was not opposed to actually doing what FDR did, or at least that's kind of the way that I got what I got from reading his book.
Right. You know, I think in later years, as he came under attack from as being a conspiracy theorist, I think his views on FDR hardened a little bit. But you're right. You know, when you look at this and you don't have any other context besides Pearl Harbor, if you don't know about the Lusitania and other events, and you're just trying to figure out Pearl Harbor by itself, you try to rationalize it, and that's what most people do. You know, I've been years ago, I've written on Pearl Harbor since 1986 when I wrote a cover story for the New American on Pearl Harbor, and that was Priest in it. And I'd go on radio shows, and it would be typical for the host to say, well, and it wasn't that awful about Pearl Harbor, but then we went into the war, and, you know, we did what we had to do, you know. And and so FDR returns then to being the noble leader. And so people try to figure it out, and they try to say, well, you know, he must have had some good reason. He felt it was worth the sacrifice of a few thousand people to save a few million. That kind of attitude. Well, you know, that's not the way good people do things. As the Bible teaches us, you know, a bad tree does not bear good fruit. And to sacrifice people, that ends justifying the means. That's not the Christian or American way. That's the communist way. Suborn murder for a noble cause, that is not noble. If a noble man, a man who's committed to a good cause, if he wanted to get us into that war, the way he needed to do it was constitutional. He needed to go to the American people and to tell them, well, this is the case where, you know, prove to the people that Japan and Germany are really trying to conquer the world and represented a true threat to American interests. He needed to make his case and let the people decide, not through trickery, not through deceiving the commanders, not through betraying the men at Pearl Harbor, not through deceiving the American people. Deception is a trait not of a godly man. It's a trait of Satan. Deceit might even, along with pride, are probably the two chief characteristics of Satan. So this is not a admirable thing. And also, by the way, good men take responsibility for their actions. They don't scapegoat people, which is exactly what happened to the commanders in Hawaii, Kimmel and Short, which is something that we should also get into in the course of this conversation. But
sure.
FDR's behavior did not indicate a man with a noble cause at heart, despite how much whitewashing has been done by the court historians.
Sure. And of course, his whole history is one of deceit. I mean, he was even deceitful in his personal life with his family. So he's definitely consistent in his behavior.
And, you know, the Illuminati, or the what Ferdinand Lundberg in 1937 called America's 60 Families, they're not ever going to let a good man get to be president. Well, good, that's a pretty broad term, but they will only let people get to be president who are compromised and who are willing to trade that position for obedience to their dictates. We saw that with Woodrow Wilson when he was brought before the bankers. When he spoke to Bernard Baruch, he pledged to do their bidding. He pledged to support a central bank. He pledged to support an income tax. And, of course, both of those became reality in 1913, which was his first year in office. And he pledged to accept advice on who should be in his cabinet. And his cabinet was actually handpicked by Edward Mandelhaus. And, of course, that was right before the Council on Foreign Relations had been birthed. So they had to have another means of recruitment and selection of cabinet members. And he also pledged to lend an ear to advice should war break out in Europe. And he did all those things. And you can be sure that anyone who gets to be president in this past century has done so by making those types of pledges.
Oh, absolutely. And your referral to that book, The 60 Families, I have that book also. And it is amazing because it really does tell you who's pretty much behind the leadership of this country, and it started very early on. And he wrote another book too. What was the name of the other book that he wrote?
The Rich and the Super Rich.
Yes.
Which was 30 years later, and he showed that nothing had changed. But just to give an I love Lundberg. You know, that book's out of print. That book should be in print. I had to get a library edition of that. But Lundberg said this. In 1937, he said this, quote, "The United States is owned and dominated today by a hierarchy of its 60 richest families. These families are the living center of the modern oligarchy which dominates the United States, functioning under a democratic form of government, behind which a de facto government, absolutist and plutocratic, has taken form. This de facto government is actually the government of the United States, invisible, shadowy. It is the government of money and a dollar democracy," unquote. What a great quote. And that's from 1937. That's before Pearl Harbor. That's almost 80 years ago, and nothing has changed. In fact, the consolidation of power has certainly increased with, as you see, the consolidation of media, the consolidation of banking, and even the consolidation of nations, as we see the European Union and the proposed North American Union taking place. They're all about consolidation, because when you consolidate, you get control. You get no opportunity for dissent.
Right. Well, it's also the consolidation of food production and farming and everything, aspect of our lives, so that you're getting rid of the independent merchants for the great big huge superstores. But reading Lundberg's books, and I would venture to say, you mentioned the Illuminati, and somebody sent me an email and said, well, who exactly controls? Who is in charge of the Illuminati? Who's ahead of it? And I believe that probably the question would be, which families are controlling this? And they really, I don't think they consider themselves, oh, yes, we are the Illuminati and disguise the head. It is the way that they operate together and they cooperate together. And when I think of the word Illuminati, I think of not a particular functional group. It's functional, but it's not like, oh, we're going to go to the Illuminati meeting tonight down at the local restaurant. But a de facto kind of a group that functions together to facilitate a particular agenda, which would be world government, world control.
Right, and that's, I think, pretty much the position that Lundberg was taking. But I think also it's true that as time has progressed, they do have formal ways of meeting together. Of course, the Council on Foreign Relations is a method by which government policy is formulated in a centralized location. But then they have the Bohemian Grove meetings where things are privately discussed. You've got the meetings of the Skull and Bones. You've got the Bilderberg meetings annually, the Trilateral Commission. Mm-hmm. So they do have ways of getting together to coordinate policy internationally.
Right. But there's no they don't refer to themselves as the Illuminati. And when I think of the Illuminati, I also think of the gift from France, that of the Statue of Liberty, which, if people really knew the history of it and how it came to be, that is a sign that literally we have been taken over by a secretive group of people, and it doesn't really mean what we all think, what we all used to think it meant, that, oh, it was a land of freedom and this is the light of this will illuminate the liberty. No. That's not what that means at all. So,
well, freedom is a word, but if it's not supported or enforced, you'll certainly lose it. And they love to create illusions of democracy and freedom, even while they're taking it away. It's interesting, for example, after 9/11, that President Bush characterized the attacks as an attack on our liberties, yet right after that, you had the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security, which were removing liberties. They play a great deal with semantics, and you write about the Statue of Liberty, and we should also mention, I mentioned the Bilderbergers and the Trallettes, but we should also not forget to mention the secret societies, and I would include within that the upper levels of the hierarchy of Freemasonry, and of course, we're not referring to the Blue Lodge, first, second, third degree Masons. My own grandfather was a Freemason, and he said there was no conspirator, but I've certainly seen evidence that there is, at the very height of Freemasonry, what they call the illuminated Freemasons, who are actually Satan worshippers. And I don't doubt that, because if you look into the works of, just speaking of Satan worship in general, Ted Gunderson, late head of the FBI's office in Los Angeles, who's done a great, made great contributions to the alternative media before his death. William Guy Carr of Canadian Intelligence, John Coleman of MI6, which is the British CIA, all affirmed that these people are Satan worshippers, and they do operate through secret societies. Coleman mentioned the Committee of 300. That would be another one. So they definitely have a network, and many people believe, and I do believe it is symbolized by that pyramid on the back of the dollar bill, mm-hmm. where you have these levels to the pyramid, which get smaller and smaller. And according to some analysts, above that Committee of 300, which has been documented going back a century, that there are 300 men sort of governing the fate of the world, that above that 300, they say there's a committee of 33, and above that, a smaller committee. And in other words, that the levels get smaller and tighter, just like the top of a pyramid. And we don't even know the identity of the men, because they're not the public figures like the Kissinger or the David Rockefeller that we can see visibly. So we couldn't even name those men, but I don't doubt, when I see the accumulated intelligence reports coming from different countries, that such a structure does exist. Mm-hmm. They have to be powerful to engender events like Pearl Harbor and World Wars. This is more than just a few men who got together at a cocktail party.
Right, right.
And it's an organization.
And we are not going to know who they are. Absolutely, we're not going to know who they are. We're just going to see their front men, like Kissinger. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Because we always want to know, okay, who's doing this? I mean, besides, you know, the incarnate evil, we want to know who's doing this. But we may never know. We just know we know what is being done, and certainly they're well protected.
Oh, they're very well protected, because this scheme has been going on for centuries, and I do believe it is very well organized. And we can't see that organization because we're not flies on the wall at these secret meetings.
Sure.
And we don't, we're not allowed into the upper levels of Freemasonry, or we can't attend a Bilderberg meeting or a Trilateral Commission meeting to see what things are being discussed. But the fate of the world is shaped at these meetings, humanly speaking, I would not doubt for a moment.
Right. Yeah, that's a great explanation. That's great. You kind of brought it all together, that it's that makes a lot of sense. Sometimes you can read a lot of books and you grab one idea from one book and other ideas, but it's putting it all together, which you have the ability to do, that you can piece it all together and come up with a very good statement of that's rational and meaningful. Yeah, it isn't like one group. It's all these groups, and they do share commonality in that you see the same people meeting. Where you see the same people.
Right. Well, just to take the CFR as an example, you look at on the back of my book, Truth and Lonely Warrior, I enumerated that since the council was founded in 1919, there had been 21 secretaries of defense who are CFR members, mm-hmm. and 19 treasury secretaries, 18 secretaries of state, and 16 CIA directors. And how could one possibly have all these elite positions, coming from a group that actually today only has less than 5,000 members. In the days of Kennedy, had less than 1,000 members. Yet we have this same group that is dominating presidential candidates. Bill Clinton picked 12 CFR members for his cabinet. And if you look at Obama, he's got John Kerry at Secretary of State and Jacob Lew at Treasury and Chuck Hagel, I don't know about the new guy, but Chuck Hagel at Defense and his predecessor Robert Gates were CFR members, and Jay Johnson, head of Homeland Security, and Penny Pritzker at Commerce, and Ernest Moniz at Energy, and Janet Yellen at the Fed. They're all CFR members, and how can that be? And that's part of that. When Lundberg talked about this this dollar democracy, dollar government democracy, this oligarchy that runs things behind the scenes, that's how they do it. They Council on Foreign Relations act as a training center where people get a little bit of experience, and then they can go on to become a member of the U.S. government. Well, let me just give you give the listeners an example of that. This is a quote from New York Times, 1985. Headline is, investment banker is appointed to number two post at State Department. John C. Whitehead has been named the next Deputy Secretary of State. It was announced today. Mr. Whitehead retired last November as co-chairman of Goldman Sachs. Mr. Whitehead brings to the job no apparent expertise in international diplomacy. In describing his attributes for the job, Mr. Schultz said that Mr. Whitehead was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and was regularly invited to dinners given by Henry A. Kissinger, the former Secretary of State. Unquote. So the Council of Foreign Relations is how these guys from Citibank and, people look, they'll see that usually these cabinet heads are quite often come from multinational corporations, even though they don't have expertise in the department they're in. They go to the Council of Foreign Relations, attend a couple of study groups, and now they're stamped as qualified for the job. And that's how they go from Wall Street into the government, where they continue to represent Wall Street interests. But that's one way. Certainly a central way by which this oligarchy has controlled presidencies is by having their members sit in the cabinets.
Sure. And a president, a potential early on, they don't just happen. And you have to say, okay, well, you use example a while back. We're going to have Clinton or Bush, and these people are in the know. They're in the right family. Look at the Bush family, for goodness sake. The Bush family has been in government for a very, very long time. They've been running drugs. They've been doing all kinds of things. They play dirty. So they are the perfect kinds of people to play dirty at the top of the heap.
And these candidates who come forward, and become the candidate, not because the people wanted them there. And one of the examples I give in my book is Jimmy Carter. I believe it was 7 months before or 9 months before the Democratic Party convention of 1976, less than 4% of all Democrats registered favored Jimmy Carter for president. And the fact is that most people in America didn't even know who Jimmy Carter was. But then he attended a dinner at David Rockefeller's Tarrytown, New York estate. And also present was Zbigniew Brzezinski, who later became the national security advisor under Carter.
Right.
And all of a sudden, Jimmy Carter was on the cover of Time 3 times and Time's cover artists were told to make him look as much like John F. Kennedy as possible. The Wall Street Journal ran a editorial piece claiming that Jimmy Carter was the best candidate for president among all the Democratic nominees. And you had a series of pieces puffing Carter in the New York Times. Newsweek put him on their cover twice. And he's all of a sudden he's on network news, all the networks are featuring him. And so he became the candidate. He became from nobody to the candidate almost overnight. Same thing happened to Wendell Willkie, who just a few months before the Republican convention of 1940, only 3% of registered Republicans wanted him to become wanted him for their nominee. And it was just a media blitz that brought Wilkie and Carter to the fore. And that's usually the way it is. Whoever heard of Obama a few years ago, you know?
Sure.
And so they could make you and me president and vice president if they wanted to, because that's the power of consolidated ownership of mainstream media. But it's another example of how we do not truly have this democratic process where the most talented and gifted person rises to the top. They are picked, and then they are promoted, and that's how the selection process happens. And that's why we really don't have a choice when it comes to our presidents.
Exactly. Sure. Yeah. And all of the presidents and the secretaries of state belong to the Pilgrim Society, which makes them international with Britain. So, I mean, it's just, fascinating.
Yes, we mentioned Secret Society before. Pilgrim Society is an example of one more. That's right. That started shortly after the Spanish-American War, when England was the sole country to side on with America during the Spanish-American War, which is our first true interventionist war, fighting a war on somebody else's behalf, namely the Cuban people. So it is really a complex arrangement. And it's not something where you can point to any one of these groups and say, that's it, it's the CFR, it's the Bilderbergers. It is obviously a very broad, money-based agenda taking place, which has many sub-organizations within it. And even you and I, of course, don't fully understand it. And how can we? Because it's secretive. And so what we do is, based on the information we can get, we make the best educated estimate as to what's taking place. And certainly, by the policies they undertake and what the media is saying, we can get a pretty good idea, even though we're not the fly on the wall, of what their plans are.
Sure. And maybe they have all these organizations just to kind of keep us off track. I mean, one person might focus on one organization and say, oh, yeah, it's the Pilgrim Society. They're running things. Where somebody else might say, oh, you know, it's a Bilderberg, you know. But it could be a little of all of them.
For sure. Well, anyway, maybe we could steer this back to just wrapping up Pearl Harbor
a little bit.
I'm delighted, because this isn't this is great. You know, we don't have commercials. We've got 2 hours, and so if we just talked about Pearl Harbor, we'd probably be done in 45 minutes. We'd be going off on other subjects anyway. So I think it's good to go back and forth. But what happened on December the 7th is kind of interesting. In Washington, the final message of the rupture of relations was decoded. And there was a very important directive which Japan's diplomats had been given, which was to deliver it to the Secretary of State at 1 p.m. That was marked very important, 1 p.m. And the significance of this was very clear, because 1 p.m. would be right after dawn in Hawaii. It obviously meant an attack on Pearl Harbor. But they already had all this anyway. They already had all this information from all these previous warnings. But this is just final confirmation. So when this message came in, the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Harold Stark, was shown the message by his junior officers, who urged him to call Pearl Harbor and to notify Admiral Kimmel. They said this means an attack on Hawaii, and he refused to pick up the phone. And years later, he said that his conscience was clear regarding Pearl Harbor, because all of his actions on that day were dictated by what he called, quote, a higher authority, unquote, which could only refer to Roosevelt, because that was his only senior. But the really interesting adventure on the morning of December the 7th were the activities of General George Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, who knew Freemason and who knew very well about this attack in advance. In the Army Department, they decoded this message, was shown the important delivery time, and Colonel Rufus Bratton, who was the head of the Far Eastern Section, tried to reach Marshall at home, and he was told that General Marshall was out on a horseback ride. And if you see a compatriot of Bratton's in this BBC documentary, Sacrifice on Pearl Harbor, which is on my website, you'll see him say that Bratton said, I'm going to make this the most famous horseback ride since Paul Revere. He stayed on this horseback ride for a good 2 to 3 hours, finally came home, and Bratton told him, we have an emergency here at the War Department General. Please come here immediately. He took 75 minutes to make a 10-minute drive, come to the War Department, wants to look at other messages first, finally gets around to this important message. At this point, you know, we're only maybe a couple hours away from the Pearl Harbor attack. And he takes a long time to read the message and finally agrees, oh, we should notify all posts. And he said, but let's notify the Philippines first, which, of course, 1 p.m. would be, and in Washington time, at 2 a.m. in the Philippines. That's not where they're attacking. It's obviously Pearl Harbor. It's, that's when it's going to be dawn. That's when you're going to launch an attack. By the way, he sent a dispatch, which went by Western Union. It arrived in Hawaii several hours after the attack. General Marshall's message got to General Short 6 hours after the attack, and to Admiral Kimmel 8 hours after the attack, sent for him to take precautions. This was outrageous. All he had to do was, like Stark, all he had to do was pick up the phone and ask to speak to General Short, the Army commander in Pearl Harbor. That's all he had to do. And the reason he gave was, he said, well, the reason he gave when he was questioned by Congress about this years later, he said, the reason I didn't pick up my phone was because the Japs could have been listening in, and I couldn't let them know that we'd broken their codes. Well, this was absurd. His phone had a scrambler, and even if somehow the Japanese had unscrambled the message, he didn't have to say we'd broken their codes. He could have said, look, be on alert. We've heard from a spy or a submarine or a ship that Japanese ships are approaching Pearl Harbor. This was a blatantly false excuse. He did everything he could that day to prevent Pearl Harbor from being warned promptly. If he'd sent that warning in time, at least our men could have been at their post and many lives could have been saved. But he did not, and it went down in history that he had tried to save Pearl Harbor, but alas, he was too late. But the other thing is that horseback ride, the true story was busted, was exposed by inadvertently by a writer named Arthur Upham Pope, who wrote a biography of Maxim Livitnov, who was the Soviet ambassador to the United States. And he arrived and he gave a day-to-day account of the ambassador's activities on December the 7th, the morning, December 7th, Livitnov arrived at the Washington airport and Marshall met him there. That's where he was. He was not on a three-hour horseback ride. But that again was missed. And you can be sure he's there to tell him that in just a few hours that Russia was going to be receiving an avalanche of lend-lease from the White House. But that's what occurred. And, of course, despite the fact that he failed to pick up the phone, for which he should have been immediately dismissed for what he did that day. Mm-hmm. Instead, he was made America's very first five-star general. He was selected to be the man the Marshall Plan was named after, even though he had nothing to do with it. The Marshall Plan was dreamed up at the Council on Foreign Relations by a study group with David Rockefeller as its secretary. David Rockefeller really goes back a few years, but he was selected to announce the Marshall Plan because they felt that Congress would give it bipartisan support if a general announced it, and he would be perceived as neutral. He also got to become Secretary of State. And during the Korean War, he got to be Secretary of Defense to ensure that that would be a disaster, and ultimately was given the Nobel Peace Prize. That's what you get when you work for the establishment.
Isn't that something? Oh, the Nobel Peace Prize. Oh, goodness. And of course, Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize also.
Yeah, but before the seat was warm in the Oval Office, he got his Nobel Peace Prize. It was funny, there were people who satirized that. They'd have there were restaurants that say free Nobel Peace Prize with each taco. That's really to underscore the value of the Peace Prize at that point. But we also know that this Nobel Peace Prize was set up by the Zionists, of course, to reward those who served their agenda well. And actually, the 1945 Peace Prize went to Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State, who also covered up for Roosevelt that day. But that brings us to the rewards and punishments that were handed out for people, depending on whether or not they cooperated with the Pearl Harbor cover-up. I should mention that the cover-up of Pearl Harbor, of course, there were demands for accountability. You know, everybody, congressmen and people around America were saying, how come we were caught off guard? How come we had this disaster? How come we weren't ready for it, right? So Roosevelt appointed an official commission, and this will remind you of the 911 commission, but It was called the Roberts Commission. He appointed a Supreme Court justice he was very friendly with to head it, Owen Roberts. And also on that commission were Major General Frank McCoy, who was a close friend of Marshall's, Brigadier General Joseph McNarney, who was on Marshall's staff, Joseph Reeves, who was a retired admiral who had been given a job in Lend-Lease by Roosevelt, and William Stanley, who was a former fleet commander, who was the only one who seemed to not be part of that set. But, you know, when these commissions are found, Deanna, they're willing to let one dissenter be on there to give it an appearance of freely handled commission. They do that with the Supreme Court. They'll let one or two good guys get in there because they know that they'll always be outvoted. And it makes it, gives it the appearance that there's actually some semblance of free dissent within the official body. But the Roberts Commission interviewed Marshall and Stark, the chief of naval operations. And when Admiral Stanley, who was a member of the commission, arrived, he found it very chummy. No, the testimony was being taken unsworn and then recorded. And they went out to Hawaii, where they spent 19 days. And when Admiral Kimmel, the fleet commander, came, he brought a fellow officer to act as his counsel. And Owen Roberts, the head of the commission, disallowed this. He says, well, Admiral, you're not on trial. So we're not going to permit any counsel here. This is not a legal court case. It's just an informal hearing. Well, of course, that meant that he had no rights of a defendant, so he couldn't ask questions. He couldn't cross-examine anybody. And he found that testimony he gave was left out of the report. And that report ended up by concluding that Pearl Harbor was the result of dereliction of duty on the part of Kimmel and Short. Short, again, is the Army commander in Hawaii. And said that everyone in Washington had discharged their duties in an exemplary manner. And the words dereliction of duty appeared on headlines across America. Kimmel and Short got death threats. And they were treated abominably. They were demoted and they were compelled to resign. And that's how they were treated. But this is something that's pretty important. They wanted to be court-martialed because they knew in a court-martial they could have a defense attorney who could represent them. At this point, they still didn't know about the magic intercepts. They didn't know that they'd been tricked. But finally, in 1944, Congress mandated that these trials be held. And so in 1944, these trials had not been held because Roosevelt said, in the interest of national security, we can't do this. But 1944, we're obviously winning the war, so Congress said, we're going to have these trials now. So 1944 in August, the Naval Court of Inquiry and the Army Pearl Harbor Board met, and at these hearings, Admiral Kimmel's attorneys had found out about the messages that had been held back from him, and they were able to obtain these messages, and the Naval Court of Inquiry completely exonerated Admiral Kimmel of all charges and laid all blame on Washington. This was a wonderful verdict. It was a true verdict. And the Army Pearl Harbor Board reached the same conclusion that Washington had full foreknowledge. And here is what they said in the report, quote, up to the morning of December the 7th, 1941, everything that the Japanese were planning to do was known to the United States, unquote. That is the official verdict of the Army Pearl Harbor Board. Now, isn't this amazing? This is 1944. This is not some conspiracy theorist 60 years later. It's 1944, and it's official that Washington knew. Now, how come the public didn't react with outrage? Because these results were quashed. President Roosevelt said they must be held top secret. We can't let the Japanese know we broke their codes. But the admiral said, well, how can the verdict of innocence of Admiral Kimmel be considered classified? But it was classified, and immediately President Roosevelt took steps to see that these trial verdicts would be reversed. And so Major Henry Clausen, later Lieutenant Colonel Henry Clausen, was ordered by the War Department to investigate this matter further and to supplement the findings of the Army Pearl Harbor Board. And also the Navy was given the task of supplementing the findings of the Naval Court of Inquiry. This was handed over to Lieutenant Commander John Sonnet. Who, by the way, it's absolutely without precedent for Lieutenant Commander to overturn a verdict rendered by admirals and for a major to overturn the verdict of generals. But this is basically what happened. What they did was they went around to all the witnesses who had testified to seeing the winds message and other evidence of Pearl Harbor, and the hand was forced of these witnesses, and witness after witness. I'll give you an example. Colonel Rufus Bratton had testified before the Army Pearl Harbor Board. They delivered this important terminative message, the 13-part message to General Marshall on the 6th. Now he's flagged down on the highway by Henry Clausen, who hands him an affidavit from Marshall's secretary and General Giroux, who was the chief of war plan, saying that Marshall never got that message. Well, what do you do? It's your word against the Army chief of staff. What do? He signed a new affidavit saying he must have been mistaken. And that happened to witness after witness until finally, when the official report was announced to the public, they waited until the day that American troops were arriving in Japan when no one would care. And they reversed the findings of the Army Pearl Harbor Board and the Naval Court of Inquiry, saying that further evidence had discredited these findings. So the public never found out what those hearings revealed. And that's why many revisionist authors after the war, through the small alternative media press, tried to bring the truth out about Pearl Harbor. But let me just mention Henry Clausen, who conducted that investigation.
Mm-hmm.
You know what happened to him? This is where I wanted to bring in the rewards and punishments. Henry Clausen.
I know.
Sorry, I got to turn to the page. I want to get this title right. Okay. Henry Clausen went on to become the sovereign grand commander of the Scottish Rite of the Southern Jurisdiction. That is the highest position within Freemasonry. Of course, you know that President Roosevelt was a 33rd degree Freemason and General Marshall was a Freemason. So see what kind of a reward. His 16 years he held that position. When he was a major in the Army conducting this reinvestigation of the Army Pearl Harbor Board. As for the guys on the Roberts Commission, Rear Admiral Reeves, that same year he signed the official report condemning Kimmel and Short, was advanced to full admiral by President Roosevelt for, quote, eminent and conspicuous service in the Spanish-American War. Now, the Spanish-American War happened 44 years ago, and now he gets promoted for it. Brigadier General McNarney, who was on the Roberts Commission, the very month he signed that report was promoted to Major General. Then he became Lieutenant General, full general, and after the war, he replaced Eisenhower as commander of American occupation forces in Germany. Admiral Stanley, the same month he signed the report, was given the Distinguished Service Medal, and the following month was appointed ambassador to the Soviet Union. And one reason they wanted to make him ambassador to the Soviet Union was he disagreed with the findings and they didn't want any reporters asking him any questions. General Marshall, as I mentioned, became the first five-star general, got all those other appointments, Secretary of State and so forth. Brigadier General Giroux was made Lieutenant General and Commander of the 15th Army. And again, Secretary of State Cordell Hull got the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, men who tried to tell the truth about Pearl Harbor, like Captain Lawrence Safford, who was absolutely defiant. He was the head of Naval Radio Intelligence. He insisted we knew about it. He was never promoted, nor was Colonel Otis Sadler, nor was Colonel Rufus Bratton. The men who told the truth, their careers went nowhere. And that is a lesson on how the material world works and how this oligarchy works. You cooperate, you will get rewards. And we won't get them in heaven, but you'll get them here on earth.
Right. And the Short and Kimmel families, even in the 1990s, went to Congress and asked that their relatives, their parents and grandparents be exonerated. And Congress still held, they said, no, what'd they do? They spent a few days on it, a few hours, and said, no, we're going to maintain what was found then, and we uphold that decision. We're not going to change.
Yes, a recommendation was made to the Pentagon to reinvestigate this matter, and this is a statement from December 1, 1995. The Undersecretary of State, the Undersecretary of Defense, Edward Dorn, said, quote, I cannot conclude that Admiral Kimmel and General Short were victims of unfair official actions, and thus I cannot conclude that the official remedy of advancement on the retired list is in order, unquote. However, there was a mini-probe by Congress in 1999, 4 years later, that approved a resolution that said Kimmel and Short had performed their duties, quote, competently and professionally, and that our losses at Pearl Harbor were not a result of dereliction of duty, so the, unquote. So the families at least had the satisfaction of that resolution. But you're quite right. The Short and Kimmel families worked for years to uphold the reputations of their disparaged and the maligned fathers.
And of course, we don't see on the front page of the New York Times any of this information about that they were not in dereliction of their duties, but that they were not to blame for the 2,400 people being killed. We did not see that on the front page of the New York Times. And a lot of people by the 1990s could care less about what happened because they've already bought into the court historian version, and it's just not relevant.
Yes, isn't it quite amazing that all the stuff we've been talking about today does not appear in any mainstream college textbook about World War II? All you're going to read about is that the Japanese attacked us, and none of this controversy about Kimmel and Short, the decoded intercepts, the investigations is not there. Again, this is why you have to turn to alternative media. But I want to also mention something here which is important for listeners to know, too. It's not just people like you and me talking about this. You go back to 1947, you had George Morgenstern, who was a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, write the book Pearl Harbor, The Story of the Secret War, which he revealed many of these facts, and many of the facts he didn't know yet, but he made the case that Washington knew. Then you had, in 1954, Robert Theobald, who was a rear admiral who was in Pearl Harbor on the day of the attack, wrote The Final Secret of Pearl Harbor, the Washington contribution to the Japanese attack. And after the year after that, as Admiral Kimmel came out with his book, Admiral Kimmel's Story. But, you know, they had to go to the small alternative press, Regnery and Devon Adair, because they would not be taken on by the major, you know, Doubleday and the big publishing houses. And they should, right? I mean, if they're interested in the big story, wouldn't you want to print Admiral Kimmel's story, the Pacific Fleet commander? But no, he had to go to a small press. I really consider that John Tolan's book, that was a landmark book for me. He really did so much work. And, you know, here's another guy. You know, we're talking about how people evolve. I saw, it might have been on IHR's website. I think they have an article, The Evolution of John Tolan, or a title to that effect, how he started out as sort of a mainstream. And the more he investigated, the facts came to light. And then he became a speaker sometimes at IHR events. Mm-hmm. And revisionist events. And he, as a Pulitzer Prize winner, he told the truth about Pearl Harbor in his book Infamy. And then, of course, you have Robert Stinnett with the book we already mentioned, Day of Deceit. And then you have George Victor, published a book in 2007 called The Pearl Harbor Myth. And recently, Percy Greaves' book, Pearl Harbor, The Seeds of Fruit and Fruits of Infamy, it's published in 2010, but it's exhaustive. It's 937 pages, but it really concentrates on the earlier stuff because he'd been on the congressional, on the staff of the Joint Congressional Committee that investigated Pearl Harbor, but which unfortunately rendered a verdict favorable to Roosevelt because the Democrats had a majority on it. But there's that, and there's that BBC documentary we mentioned, Sacrifice of Pearl Harbor. And there's also a pretty good internet database is called the Pearl Harbor Archive, and I've got links to all of these resources my website article, which is where you just click on the blog, that article will come up.
Indeed. And of course, after these people come out and write these books, then all of a sudden they're not promoted by their previous publishers. They kind of get marginalized and sidetracked and whatnot, which is unfortunate.
That's right. Harry Aylmer Barnes wrote about that back in the 1950s, how everybody had been cut out. Charles Beard, and he named quite a few historians besides himself, who no longer were welcomed by the publishers who welcomed their work before. Have you tried to tell the truth? There was a big transformation that occurred after World War II, Deanna. And let me get this quote. This is a quote from Charles Beard, who was actually president of the American Historical Association. This is what he said in 1947. In the Saturday Evening Post, he wrote this quote, "The Rockefeller Foundation and Council on Foreign Relations intend to prevent a repetition of what they call the debunking journalistic campaign following World War I. This means that the Foundation and the Council do not want journalists to examine too closely and criticize too freely the official propaganda and statements relative to our basic aims and activities during World War II. In short, they hope that the policies and measures of Franklin D. Roosevelt will escape in coming years the critical analysis, evaluation, and exposition that befell the policies and measures of Woodrow Wilson and the Allies after World War I, unquote, Charles Beard. So that's exactly what happened, right, Deanna, is that after World War II, there's just a ton of propaganda, and the number of World War II movies, they never stop. I mean, Schindler's List and Private Ryan and Indiana Jones and Wind Talkers. And when I was a kid in the 60s, there was a Great Escape and, the Dirty Dozen. And they never stopped making movies about, we just pounded that big lie over and over again because they realized after World War I had been debunked, they said, we're not going to let that happen this time. And so that's why this war, of all the wars we've fought, is the toughest to talk to people about because it's the one that's been most heavily propagandized and the one that's been big lied the most. And so it's fact in people's mind, and it really takes a lot. But one reason I write about Pearl Harbor, Deanna, is I find that that's a pretty good entrance point. There's so much evidence pointed to Pearl Harbor. That is a good entrance point to showing people that there's another side to the Second World War.
Exactly. And didn't the CFR produce a lot of that propaganda? I mean, certainly Hollywood produced a lot. But they had a lot of writers, and they were going to prevent what happened after World War I. And so they were going to write the story themselves, a lot of the people at the CFR. And then they paid people to write books that favored the victor's version.
That's absolutely correct. It was the court historians, and the court historians got great reviews, of course, in the New York Times. And, of course, they would become the Book of the Month Club. And I remember my mother subscribed to the Book of the Month Club. So what are you going to hear but propaganda, you know, when you subscribe to that? And, of course, they also control the newspapers and as we're saying, the movie studios. And so how could you find out the truth? And that's why it's good that we have the opportunity of the internet now in alternative media and blogs, whereby we can bring this information out. Because back then, unless you happened to be connected to someone who read one of these small press books, you just didn't have that opportunity unless you connected to maybe the John Birch Society in the 1960s or before that. One of the minor groups was out there, but there wasn't much chance. I mean, your public library wasn't going to bring that information in. The three major television networks weren't going to do it for you. So it was tough. It's always been an uphill battle. We're the underdogs, but the people like to root for the underdog. Maybe that's one thing we have on our side. But the other thing we have on our side that's even more important is that we're telling people the truth. And that is what I think our big advantage comes in, that our explanation of things makes sense. Their explanation does not make sense except to fulfill their assignment to be rewarded for justifying the geopolitical actions of the oligarchy that's paying them their salaries.
Sure. And you brought up public libraries. And, of course, those were co-opted a long time ago. And although they are taxpayer-funded, the taxpayers are paying for their own brainwashing, their own indoctrination. And it's kind of unusual. I attempted to place a book written by an Afghani into my local library, and it's called Afghanistan After Democracy. And the librarian, the head librarian, who makes those decisions, held on to that book for like 3 months, and I kept calling, and she said, finally, she said, well, we just don't want to have this book in the library because it has these graphic pictures of, you know, deformed babies and children and everything. And she said, we just don't want to have a book that has this graphic these graphic images. And I'm thinking, what do you mean? You have all these R-rated movies. What are you saying? You know, it's okay to have Hollywood movies with sex and all kinds of blatant violence, but you cannot have a book that depicts what has gone on, and is going on in Afghanistan. Ah, amazing. I mean, that's to me. Go ahead.
Oh, you probably should have asked, well, are you going to move all your books on the Holocaust with all their images?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Because they must have those, and how many horrific images are in those books?
Indeed. Yes. Oh, my gosh. Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah, obviously, this was obviously an excuse. And unfortunately, actually, my wife went to, was trained as a librarian. She has a college degree, a master's degree in library science. And it's very, very politically correct. The entire educational system, of course, is funded by the same foundations that are attached to the same financial hierarchy that runs the media and the government. And so their entire background is, I presume, to discriminate against anything that would upset the apple cart. And I'm sure it depends on the individual librarian and where her heart is at. But they're obviously part of the system.
Absolutely. And when you look at the history of how public libraries became, how they were initiated, the Carnegie Institute is one that that promoted a library in every community. And so they kind of set up the parameters of how they would be run and what they would hold and what they would accept. So just about everything is tainted with those that same agenda that we talked about before. And it
That's
is very
right.
pervasive.
And when you pay the bills, you get to call the shots on how things are run, and that's true in any endeavor. And you're so right. This has been the whole informational system we have in America has been created. They call it information, but it's really a agenda-based, and the same is true for colleges and public schools. The same, they're really there to advance an agenda, to indoctrinate, not to educate or to teach people to critically think.
Right. Wow. Well, this is really a fabulous, fabulous article, and I hope that people will share it and read it and look at all of the links and the photos and the images. And I mean, it's just fabulous the way that you put this together. And it's very, very scholarly. Love it. Just absolutely terrific. And just terrific. Sam, thank you so much for being on the program. It's been, I always enjoy visiting with you. I always learn so much when you're on the program.
Well, I've learned so much from you because in your trilogy, The Ruling Elite, you cover so much data that I hadn't seen before about early America, what was going on in the 19th century, which I hadn't really looked at. My studies kind of take me back to the Spanish-American War, but there's this whole void. There were voids of my knowledge base that were empty that you were able to fill in for me, so I just really appreciate that. And that, like I say, on my bookshelf, your books are like an encyclopedia. I understand that some of the mainstream encyclopedias were put out there, again, for that purpose of indoctrination, but yours are out there for telling people the truth. And so I do want to recommend that people order those books, and I'm just delighted you have a new one coming out.
Well, thank you so very, very much. And these false flags, I think there's also a tendency to call everything that occurs a false flag. And you kind of made a distinction when you said false flags are used typically to start a war against another country. Because I think that there are people who use that term without understanding the significance behind it. It is usually to start a war against another flag, a country that has another flag. Correct?
Yes, I guess it has fallen to broader usage. So some people might have called Ebola a medical false flag to try to create a medical mm-hmm. police state, that kind of thing.
Sure.
But I think, yes, the original more confined use of that term was in terms of generating war, as you say, against a flag. And that's probably why we have the word flag in that phrase.
Yeah. But, I think of all the wars that have been started – using a false flag, even going back to the Civil War. Anyway, thank you so very much for being on the program today. And I haven't even checked to see if we have any callers, which we didn't. I've been checking the chat room, and people have really appreciated you being on the program and have been making wonderful comments. So thank you so much, and keep up the great work.
You too, Diana, and sometime we'll have to do a broader show on World War II, since we've kind of put our foot in the door with this talk on Pearl Harbor.
Oh, absolutely. Let's do it. Okay. Thanks so much.
Okay. Have a great day to you and your listeners. Bye-bye.
All righty. Thank you. Bye-bye.
It starts with you and me.
It starts with you and me.